So, yes, we can start. So, maybe I should say finish, because now we're coming to the very end of the gradual training here. So this is the kind of these are the results of the practice. What happens when we do all these things? When we keep on purifying in this way? So what we have been looking at now is basically all the kind of purification process. Not quite finished yet. There's a little bit more of purification to be done, and then we come to the results of all that that whole process at the very end. That is kind of the exciting part. Where is it all leading to? Okay, so at the very end now. So this is the MN27. We're finishing off the gradual training, right? Okay. So let's say what it says, and then we'll see it as we go along. So this is now paragraph 17, MN 27. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue and this noble restraint of the faculties, and possessing this noble mindfulness and full awareness, he resorts to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, a hillside cave, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket, an open space, a heap of straw, or perhaps Jhana Grove Meditation Center. So here you can see, you possess these things, you bring these things with you, right? You possess all the things we have been doing on the path so far. You bring this with you into the final stage here, or what we're looking at. And it is really only at this point that it says here, you resort to a secluded resting place. It means that you find a place which is far away, right? And that is where you abide and where you live, in a sense. And it's only at this stage of the path that you actually abide, that you go to a secluded place to do your meditation practice. Up to this point, you're still fairly, you can do things in a community or whatever, but at this point, that meditation really starts to take off. And that's why it says you go to a secluded place. This is meditation, really, in the end, is about is going into seclusion. That's where the real meditation happens, according to the suttas. That's where it can happen. So these are the typical kind of resting places where you would abide to undertake meditation proper. It is interesting, the Buddha says in a couple of places in the sutta, he says that unless you actually have pretty much abandoned all the defilements of the mind, it's not really the time yet to go into seclusion. There's always a danger about seclusion. Seclusion can be can actually make it go crazy unless you are ready, unless the defilements are already subdued. And that's why you wait until this stage. It's not at this stage that you really can make use of the idea of seclusion. And so there's this idea in the suttas of what they call a kaya viveka and citta viveka. Viveka is the word for seclusion or from being aloof or being away in Pali. And kaya is the body. So you start off with seclusion of the body. This is what's happening here. You go off to the root of a tree, right? You go somewhere far away. Seclusion of the body. Taking you out of the sensual realm. Taking you out of the busyness of ordinary life. And then going somewhere far away. And it is that kaya viveka which then makes it possible later on to gain the citta viveka. And citta is the seclusion of the mind. So that's what we're aiming at, is a seclusion of the mind. But that begins with a physical seclusion, first of all, in any of these places. So this here is the sign that now we are moving into the realm of real meditation, this idea that you find a secluded resting place. This is kind of a standard phrasing in the suttas that indicate that we're moving on towards meditation proper. And meditation proper then means satipatthana. That's what meditation is in the suttas. Satipatthana is meditation practice. So now we're moving into the realm of satipatthana at this point. Satipatthana, like often translated as the foundations of mindfulness. Perhaps another translation is that the focuses of mindfulness might be preferable. It's the idea that you're using your mindfulness to be able to go even further in the meditation practice. So why is it? Why is it that we need to do so much other stuff before we sit down and meditate properly? Why is that? What is the reason for that? I mean, we have been doing all this stuff, and only now do we come to meditation practice. Does that mean that we can't do any meditation in our ordinary lives? What does this actually mean in practice? Why is it? And this is just the thing that I have been sort of focusing on on a number of occasions. The idea that as long as there is still defilements in the mind, as long as there is desire, right? The mind does not rest in the present moment. Desire, by its very nature, draws the mind into the future, into the possible gratification from the essential objects that we desire. And ill will often draws us into the past, draws us into the problematic relationships that we have with somebody or whatever it is. So desire and ill will, by their very nature, does not allow the mind to stay in the present moment. Sometimes you can have a little bit of kind of distance from your desires, and you can sort of observe it, but you're still not fully in the present moment, because that as long as that desire is in the mind, at least part of the mind will be drawn into the future or the past. So only this is why there is so much purification is actually required before mindfulness can be strong enough, right? And when all that purification happens, mindfulness becomes powerful. The mind is in the present. And when it is in the present, that's when you can start observing the present phenomena. You can see the phenomena in the present moment. That's when you can watch the breath, right? Fully, 100%, not being at all drawn to the past or drawn to the future. So this is why this purification process is so... there's so much of it before meditation really takes off. That does not mean that you cannot do any kind of meditation in ordinary life, but it's not really the full Buddhist or the Buddha's meditation. It is a kind of a lesser thing that you use just to feel a bit peaceful, feel a bit good about yourself, have a bit of metta for the people around you, right? You use it for that purpose. It is still useful, but it's not... It is not satipatthana as such. It is not mindfulness of breathing of the type that the Buddha was talking about. So it is profound. Buddhist meditation is very profound and very deep. And that's why it's something that really, in the end, only happens in real solitude, the Buddha says here. Okay. So it happens in any of these places, right? The charnel grounds, the jungle thickets, the open spaces, anywhere which is kind of far away from the world of the cities and the people and all this kind of thing. So, and then this is how this meditation happens. This is the next thing which shows us that this is all about meditation practice. On returning from his arms round after his meal, he sits down, folds his legs crosswise, setting his body erect and establishing mindfulness before him. This is another phrase that you will see in the sutta. This is exactly the same phrase that you see at the beginning of the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing. Exactly the same phrase. So again, it's an indication we're moving into the realm of meditation at this point. And you will see here, you sit down, right? He sits down. Meditation The real meditation that we come into now happens usually in the sitting posture here. Because that is when you have enough stability and enough focus to be able to be 100% aware of what is going on in your mind or with your object of meditation. The ideas in the walking meditation is a bit more loose. You can focus a lot there as well, but you can't go as deep in walking meditation as you can in sitting meditation. So walking meditation is often useful for other things like contemplation often and other stuff. Whereas if you want to get into the breath meditation in particular, then you sit down. The sitting posture is really the one that you use. And then you fold your legs crosswise. And sometimes you will hear that unless you sit cross-legged, you cannot meditate. And I think that's taking it a bit too far. I think the purpose here is that this was the natural posture in those days. This was what people felt comfortable with because they were grown up like this. People would sit on the floor very commonly. So that is why this is used. And I think it is still a good posture. Once you get used to it, it's quite nice. But for many people, it is not really... You can't really do that. You can't sit cross-legged on the floor in comfort. And it's important to be comfortable. Comfort comes prior to what kind of posture you have. As long as you're comfortable, that is the most important thing. When you're comfortable, you can let go of the body, right? And then that you are heading in the right direction. So this is just not to be taken as an absolute requirement by any means. Any sitting posture is fine. You're setting your body erect, right? And this is the idea, again, is that when your mindfulness starts to become established, it is natural for you to have... You sit kind of naturally very straight, right? This is what happens with when mindfulness becomes established. You want to sit straight. It feels right. It feels correct. But sometimes if we use too much force, we think that, oh, I have to sit straight, right? Otherwise I can't meditate, because that's what it says in the sutta. You've got to sit straight first. But sometimes you have to wait till the time is right. If you use too much force just to sit straight at the very beginning, it means that you're not ready for it, and you create tension, and you create too much willpower instead of actually being able to relax properly and enjoy the meditation. So again, everything has to be at the right place at the right time. You do it too early, and it causes hindrances in your meditation, right? I'm going to sit straight. I'm going to have the perfect posture. But the perfect posture depends on where you're at. Depends on which stage you have achieved. And it's only at this stage that the posture really should be really straight and really kind of that posture comes naturally. So allow things to come naturally. Don't force it too much. And this is what this is about. And establishing mindfulness before him or before you. How do we do that? And this is just allowing. You allow the mind to kind of come into its natural, find its own peace, right? You do the passive observer business. Just allow things to come to peace, and then you are aware as that happens. You're the passive observer. This is one way of establishing mindfulness. Things just calm down by themselves, and then mindfulness is established. And of course, the establishing of mindfulness is possible again because of all the other things we have done beforehand, right? Because we've been practicing this path all the way from the beginning, all the way to this point. That is why establishing mindfulness becomes possible. Without that, you can't establish mindfulness. You sit down, you wait for mindfulness to come, and it never arrives, right? Because it doesn't arrive because you haven't done the preliminary work. So only you can rest and relax when the preliminary work has been done, and then mindfulness is just there, right? You just tap into it, you just wait, and there it is right away. So this is the power of all these other factors coming into play, the whole path coming together at this point. And this is how mindfulness becomes established before you. Before you is just a sense of here and now, right? And this, in this, right here, right now, in front of you. When you have a mindfulness of breathing, you have a sense of being aware in this area here somewhere. So just parimukha is the Pali word, and then it is a bit debated what it means, but I think before him or before you is probably a good translation for that. So now we are really, this is all about the real kind of meditation practice. And then you might be surprised, because it's all about meditation, you might be surprised by what comes next. And the next thing here, I'll read the next part out. abandoning covetousness for the world, he abides with a mind free from covetousness. He purifies his mind from covetousness. By abandoning ill will and hatred, he abides with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. He purifies his mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he abides free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light, mindful and fully aware. He purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated, with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, he abides having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states. He purifies his mind from doubt. So these are the five hindrances. Sometimes it's a bit surprising. You wonder, well, you know, we've been doing all this purification all the time, so why suddenly now are we talking about abandoning the five hindrances? That's what we've been doing all the way, right? So what does this mean? Why is this coming now? The point here, and this is what you see again throughout the suttas, the point here is that what is still a few defilements left in the mind, right? You have come to this point, you have used your sense restraint, you have used your wisdom and all these things to try to abandon as much as you possibly can. But in daily life, you can only go so far. When you're doing, even this is for a monastic, and even for a monastic, when you go around on your arms around, you do all the other stuff you have to do, it is very difficult to abandon the hindrances 100%. There's still going to be a residue left in the mind. And this is when the suttas talk about abandoning the five hindrances in this way. It is about abandoning that last residue, that little things that still are there, the things that kind of stop you from becoming 100% and completely peaceful. So this is what this is, right? You can see how this purification process is so long, right? You come all this way. At this point, you probably already think that I haven't got any defilements in my mind. My mind is pure. And still, there is this residue which is still there, which is kind of very deep, and these tiny little defilements which are there. So, how then? How do these things come to be abandoned? It just says here, abandoning these things, you abandon ill will, you abandon sloth and torpor and covetousness. What is that? How do you do that? Do you just sit down and you kind of, how do you actually abandon these things? It doesn't say. So, and the reason it doesn't say is because this is taught elsewhere in the suttas, and this is where satipatthana, the focus as a mindfulness, comes in. That is how you abandon these last defilements. This is where breath meditation comes in. This is how you abandon these things. This is where suttas like the Upakilesa Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya 128 come in. It talks in great detail about how to abandon the refined defilements of the mind. All of these suttas come in into play here. So how you abandon this is just by meditation practice, right? You just watch the breath. And if you watch the breath in the right way, then this abandoning comes about as a consequence of that. That's really all it means. So you do that, and then you these things become abandoned. A good example that shows you how this abandoning comes into how it happens in more detail is to look at the Satipatthana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 10. Often, some people say this is a very important sutta, and it's an important one for meditation practice. And it gives you a very detailed idea of how to abandon the hindrances. So first of all, the Satipatthana Sutta is quite interesting the way it's structured. It starts off with contemplation of the body. And the main aspect of the contemplation of the body there is the 31 parts of the body. This is the main thing. Not 32, actually 31. 32 is a later thing. So there are only 31 parts of the body. Not that it matters all that much. This is the first thing, and you can see the reason why you focus on the 31 parts of the body is because to abandon desire for the body, right? This is one of the biggest problems, and you have the first hindrance here, abandoning covetousness for the world. It's actually a very bad translation. Covetousness usually in English, the traditional meaning of that word, is that you want the belongings of others. That's basically the meaning of the word covetousness. You know, in the What does it say? There's the Ten Commandments in the Bible. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's property or something like that. So it means you shouldn't really kind of desire the property of your neighbor, right? Something like that. Maybe somebody can correct me on my dodgy understanding of the Bible. But and so actually what this means is not really that. What it means is any kind of desire in the sensual realm. That is what it actually refers to. So this is not covetousness as such, it's any kind of desire in the sensual realm, and any kind of attachment to the material world, the world of the five senses. This is what this is referring to. So because of that, it is just by coming to understand the body in a more neutral way, looking at the body in terms of its 31 parts, what you're doing there is basically abandoning some of the desire for the body. But remember, you have to do all this other stuff first, right? When you've done all this other stuff, that is when you abandon this last desire for the body and you kind of give up that attachment. So this is the first satipatthana, the kaya nupassana. And that's why we do that first, because you have to overcome some of those more coarse defilements first of all. And then you move on into the Vedana Nupassana. This is the contemplation of feelings. And the contemplation of feelings is largely about it. If you look in there, it talks about different types of feelings, and it's about understanding feelings that are defiled. You can divide it into two categories, feelings that are defiled and feelings that are undefiled. And again, the purpose of this is, the large purpose of this is to understand the defilements, the problems, the things that you have to abandon. So Vedana Nupassana again helps you in that direction, to abandon the good stuff, understand what is good, understand what is bad, divide it apart, and then move in the right direction. And then you have Chitta Nupassana, which is very much a similar kind of thing. This is the understanding of the mind, and it's understanding the mind in terms of the unwholesome and the wholesome, dividing the world into those things, and being able to distinguish that. And this is one of the most important things. If you cannot distinguish the good from the bad, it is impossible to move from the bad to the good, right? You want to abandon the bad and move to the good. So you have to understand these things. Chitta Nupassana. And the last one, I think, is the most interesting one in this context, because this is the one which really allows you to abandon the hindrances fully. And that is the Dhamma Nupassana, the contemplation of Dhammas. And Dhamma here seems to mean something almost like causality, or perhaps principles, or something like that. And the Dhamma Nupassana, the way that is explained in the Satipatthana Sutta, it is explained that in terms of the five hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment. These are the two most fundamental parts of the Satipatthana Sutta, Dhamma Nupassana. So you understand, first of all, the five hindrances. You understand what the hindrance is, right? It may sound easy, but actually it isn't, because of the range is so broad. You fully understand what this hindrance is in its full range. Then you understand what causes its arising, right? Why does this hindrance arise? What is it? What am I doing that causes this hindrance to arise? The whole teaching of the Buddha is a teaching of causality. Everything has reasons. Everything has causes. Things don't exist in their own right. This is very much part of the, very closely related to the idea of non-self, right? Things don't exist in their own right. They exist because of cause and conditions. They come into being because of cause and conditions. If you have desire for something, that desire does not come out of a vacuum. It comes because of a reason. And you can see that. If you become sharp enough, you can see this causality. And then you can see that when you abandon the cause for the sensual desire to arise, then sensual desire itself fades away. If you keep on contemplating in a certain way, sensual desire does not arise in the future. So you understand what the cause is for the non-arising of sensuality in the future, right? So you get this very broad view of sensuality, or of ill will, or of sloth or torpor, whichever hindrance it is. This is how you understand these things. And this is what we are talking about here, Satipatthana practice, understanding these five hindrances. And this is how you come about to abandon these things, by understanding them in this way. But still, so that's how you do that. Still, it's a bit abstract, right? Do you just sit down and kind of watch these things? What exactly do you do? Still, it's a bit abstract to understand what you're doing here. But to make it even more concrete, the Buddha in the sutta on mindfulness of breathing, he says that the satipatthana is fulfilled simply by doing anapanasati, simply by doing mindfulness of breathing. That is enough. And you can complete the entire satipatthana. All these things I've just been talking about can be fulfilled. All you have to do is watch the breath, right? It is kind of a, it's kind of nice because you have a very practical, very straightforward method for how to fulfill the whole satipatthana. Sometimes you can see these enormous manuals on satipatthana practice. People make a lot out of it, but actually all you really have to do is watch the breath. And while you watch the breath, these hindrances will, you will start to see these hindrances more clearly, right? So it's, you're not just watching the breath, but you're also coming to understand your mind at the same time, because these things go together. Your awareness is, you know, your awareness of the breath is also an awareness of the mind. Kind of they go together. They cannot really be separated. So this is how, by watching the breath, you also have get a feeling for your defilements at the same time. You see how the breath meditation in its own right tends to overcome the defilements. Why? Because when you focus on the breath, you're not allowing your mind to go into areas where the defilements can arise. So tend to be abandoned just by the fact that you're watching the breath. And if it doesn't, well, then you start to see what is happening in your mind as well. So this is the thing. All you have to do is really watch the breath. And the breath meditation takes you all the way to the end of the satipatthana practice, all the way to the complete abandoning of these hindrances, and then into the states of samadhi. That's what it's all about. So this is how all of these things come together: the satipatthana practice, the mindfulness of breathing, and the abandonment of the last refined hindrances. It all comes together in one. It's all part and parcel of the same thing that you're seeing here. Okay, so another thing which I always found fascinating in the suttas, and this is one of the things which is probably useful to also bear in mind, there's a small little sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya which talks about two powers. Powers are like kind of two abilities in using the mind correctly. And these two powers are called the Patisankhana Bala. Bala is power in Pali. Patisankhana means reflection. The power of reflection. And the other one is the bhavana bala, the power of development, right? So what is the power of reflection? And the power of reflection, according to the Buddha, is the power, the ability to be able to give up bad misconduct in body, speech and mind, right? In other words, all the defilements, all the problems that we have are given up, Isuddha says, through the power of reflection, right? It's by reflection that we give these things up. In other words, if you think in the right way, if you are wise, if you attend in the right way, that is how these defilements get given up. And this is exactly what I've been talking about now. This is a very large stage of the path, but throughout this stage, I've been talking about using wisdom and attending in the right way to get rid of the defilements. And this is still what we're doing here. We're still learning how to attend to the defilements. We're actually learning how to abandon them. It's all about the Patisankhana, power of reflection. It's actually reflection. And this, again, it underscores this idea that it is wisdom and attending in the right way that abandons our hindrances. And then the bhavana bala, the power of development, that is the development of samadhi. The samadhi, the bhojangas, the factors of awakening, the jhanas and all this, that is the power of development. So development comes very late on the path. Prior to that, wisdom is so important. Be wise. Reflect in the correct way, reflect in the wise way, and that will abandon these defilements. Sometimes we think it's all about meditation practice, but it's also, it is. Meditation is very important, but it's about how we apply the meditation with wisdom, and then eventually with just developing the mind in jhanas later on. So this is all interesting. So what about, let's have a quick look at these defilements in terms of all the things that I've been talking about now. So first of all, we have abandoning covetousness for the world, basically abandoning a desire for the five senses, what it means, right? And this can be very refined. This is not very necessarily very coarse, right? These can be very refined things. And very often the thing that stops you from going into a state of samadhi is a slight attachment to the five senses. It's not so much that you have very much desires, right, very strong desires, you know, you're kind of thinking about food or anything like that. That's not really what it means at this stage. What it means at this stage is that you have an attachment to the senses. We are so used to this world, right, we're so immersed in everything that has to do with this world, that when this world is starting to disappear, you become afraid. Right? The five senses is the world you're used to. When that world is disappearing, you hold it back. You don't want to let go. And this is very much what comes at the very end here of this path. So you have to actually be able to let go of this world completely. Completely abandon it. And that is where what actually is happening at this stage. So remember what you are seeing here when we're talking about what is it that gives rise to the defilement of sensual desire. And the Buddha says always in the suttas, the thing that gives rise to this defilement is always seeing the beauty in the objects of that realm. Right? So we're finding happiness in that realm. As long as you find a certain amount of happiness, you think that this realm is going to create happiness for you, that is why you're holding on to that realm. And you will see this if you look at your mind. Every time a desire for a sense pleasure arises in your mind, it's always because you're seeing the beautiful in that thing. Yeah. You're seeing something satisfying, something you think will make you happy. Yeah. So this is the cause for sensual desire to arise, right? And you can see this. Look at this in your own mind. And as long as you have some idea that there is happiness to be found in this realm of the five senses, the chances are you will not be able, actually you won't be able, to let go of this realm. This is the problem. And so check it out. Look at this in your own mind. This is just theory, but look at it in your own mind. And then by reflecting, using some of the reflections I was thinking, talking about before, you can weaken that bond that you have to the world of the five senses by seeing that it isn't as simple as just happiness. There's actually much more going on there. And by weakening that bond, you are moving away from this desire for the world or attachment to the worldly, these worldly things. Okay, so that is roughly what is going on here with these hindrances. This is the first hindrance, and then you can take the second one. What about ill will? And ill will too can be very refined sometimes. It can come in many, many different varieties. So what is, if we look at it from a Satipatthana point of view, what is the cause that gives rise to ill will? And the cause that gives rise to ill will is always, as I mentioned before already, is seeing the bad side of somebody or something, right? You're seeing they are hurting me or they are something like that. And that is the problem with ill will. So again, you can watch this, you can see this in your mind, and then you can start to understand the problem there. So see, again, this is about seeing the causality of things. But I've talked about this before, so we'll move on to the next one. The next one is here, sloth and torpor. Sloth and torpor, like tiredness and lethargy, right? You're just, you don't really have, your mind is kind of weak, it doesn't have any strength, it's just tired, there's no happiness, no energy, it's the opposite of energy in the mind. And here it says, percipient of light. It's like when you have no tiredness, your mind is bright, right? A sense of brightness inside. You have a kind of clarity inside of you. So you're percipient of light. It doesn't mean that you have like a nimitta or anything like that. It can mean that, but it doesn't have to mean that. And you're mindful and fully aware. Sloth and torpor is what one of the things that stops you from being mindful and fully aware. You can have sensual desire and be angry. You can be very strongly aware, right? Because you know, if when you have desire, you think that there's something nice there, you can have a very strong awareness at that point. But it's not a peaceful awareness. It's awareness that wavers and runs after things. But with sloth and torpor, you can't really have any strong awareness at all. So this is a part of the problem here. And one of the things about these five hindrances is that you have five hindrances here. And sometimes people ask the question, well, how? I got so much sloth and torpor. I feel, you know, restless. My mind is running all over the place. How can I abandon these particular hindrances? And remember that of these five hindrances, the first two ones of ill will and sensual desire, these are by far the two most important ones. And if you're able to undermine ill will and sensual desire, you're also abandoning you're also undermining the three last ones as well. So the first two ones are by far the most important ones. These are the ones that uphold the rest of the five hindrances. So by working with those, you're working with all five. Sometimes you can't really abandon sloth and torpor and restlessness, etc., without actually working with the first two ones. Often is no direct relationship. So the first two ones are what really matters. And it's only when you come to this stage of meditation, where your mind is already very pure, it's only here that you can say that these other hindrances really can take a life of their own, so to speak, and you can actually deal with them more directly at this stage. But before this, for most of the time, all you really have to do is worry about the sensual realm, and the ill will is what you have to worry about. And the other things will disappear as a consequence. So, sloth and torpor, why does that arise? Well, again, it has to do with how you're attending to the world. You're attending to those things that give rise to sloth and torpor. And if your restlessness is the same thing, you're attending to something which makes you restless. It's all about how you use your mind. Everything here is about where you place your attention, how you use your mind, is the whole thing which underlies all of this. So how abandoning restlessness and remorse? Remorse is if your conduct is not entirely pure yet. And restlessness is obviously from very core states of feeling agitated. But restlessness goes with you all the way to samadhi. It's often just a final little movement of the mind as you go into samadhi. That is already, that is still still part of restlessness. So you abandon all that, and your mind eventually becomes inwardly peaceful. Again, restlessness too is caused largely by the first two hindrances, sense desire and ill will. So that's where we need to focus the attention again. That's where everything else comes from. All the problems arise from. And the last one is abandoning doubt. And again, it is important to understand what doubt actually means in the Buddha's teachings. It doesn't just mean doubt about kind of anything, about how to get to Perth or whatever. Of course, it's got nothing to do with that, of course. But it is specifically doubt about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. That's what you see here. He's unperplexed about wholesome states. You have no doubt about what is right and what is wrong, and what you should practice and what you shouldn't practice. And of course, most of us have some doubt, right? You sit down in meditation, sometimes you're not sure what you should be doing, not sure which way that you will get more wholesome states and which way you get more unwholesome states. Sometimes we haven't got enough clarity, it's too hard to actually see these things. So until you get to this stage, there will usually still be some doubt remaining as to what is, or uncertainty remaining as to what is really wholesome and what is not. So this is then abandoned, usually at this very stage, by focusing on trying to figure out what is wholesome in this world and what is not. And if you look at the Bhojangas, the seven factors of awakening, the second factor there is the Dhamma Vichaya, right? Dhamma Vichaya means investigation of Dhammas, investigation of qualities in the mind, basically. And that Dhamma Vichaya is specifically defined as understanding dark and bright states, unwholesome and wholesome states. So investigate this. And this is what comes just before you start to enter samadhi again. So you get a full understanding of what these things are about. So this is, you may be surprised, but this is actually a passage on meditation practice, right? This is what this really is about. This passage here, you just read now, about the five hindrances, is really about mindfulness of breathing. That's what it's hard. Sometimes you need to actually have a lot of training and see the suttas in different connections and contexts to be able to pick these things out. But after a while, it becomes clear what these things are about and how they work. So this is what you do. And of course, now your mind is getting very, very pure, right? And the purpose of this is to abandon the very last remainder of hindrances in the mind. There's nothing left remaining here. All there is a very pure mind at this stage. So what that means is that now, and only now, are we able to enter the real states of samadhi. You cannot enter samadhi if there is any the real samadhi, if there's any hindrances there. Hindrances is what blocks you, both from samadhi and also from profound insight. Both of those are blocked by the five hindrances. So let's now comes all the results of this path, right? The things that are really the really profound results that we're getting to now. So now we're getting into the samadhi states, the jhanas in particular here. So this is what the Buddha says about what happens next. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, the nivaranas, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied, it says here, by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This Brahmin is called the footprint of the Tathagata, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion. The Blessed One is fully awakened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, and the Sangha is practicing the good way. So here we have this is the standard passage for the first jhana, right? So having abandoned these five hindrances, this is always the first one. You have to abandon them first of all. That means completely, right? It doesn't mean anything left whatsoever. And these are the imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom. So at the point when these are abandoned, wisdom is no longer being weakened, right? So it means that anyone who abandons the five hindrances means that there is the potential access to wisdom, because wisdom is no longer being weakened by these things. You may remember, those of you who have read the suttas quite a bit, you may remember there's a nice sutta which talks about what is it that underpins ignorance? What is it that underpins avidya in life? What is it that kind of upholds the delusion of the mind, our misunderstanding of the world, the seeing a self where there is no self, seeing happiness where there is suffering? What is it that underpins that? And what underpins that is the five hindrances, right? Just like it says here, the five hindrances. Once you take away the five hindrances, there is no underpinning, there's no foundation, there's no support for ignorance anymore, no support for avidya. And then all you have to do then is really point your mind in the right direction. And if you point your mind in the right direction, you can make the breakthrough, because the underpinning has been removed. And now all you have to do is attend in the right way. But the problem is, and this is one of the things that why these jhana states and deep samadhi states are so important, and that is that once you start attending to things that you are not used to, you attend to non-self or to the suffering in the world and all these problems, once you attend to that, it is quite scary, right? You're seeing things you've never seen before. It isn't actually scary. It is only scary because we have something to protect inside of us. We are protecting our own delusion. We're protecting our own sense of self. We're protecting this thing which actually enslaves us and causes suffering for us. But because we're so used to it, because we take it to be ourself, we want to protect that all the time. So that is why you need a very solid foundation at this stage to be able to make the breakthrough. And that is why these states of samadhi are so powerful, to be able to have deep insight and deep wisdom into the nature of reality. Because you need something which allows you to just relax and be with things without getting fearful and protective of what is happening here. So this is the power of samadhi. And so the power of samadhi, once you have that, you have the stability afterwards to be able to deal with these very profound things. And the deeper that samadhi is, first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana, the deeper it is, the more power it has to enable you to make the breakthrough. So these are very important states in the, for this reason. That's why they are part of the Noble Eightfold Path. So at this point, the imperfections, these are the upakilesa, the defilements of the mind that weaken wisdom, have been completely abandoned. And then, instead of trying to gain the real insight at this point, the usual Buddhist path is to go via samadhi, to give you enough power, give you enough clarity to be able to make a real breakthrough. So Yeah, this does not mean that one should go around craving these states. It just means that they are part of the path. So then you have quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states. Quite secluded. Quiet is this Pali word, which is an intensifier. So it means completely secluded. That's basically what it means. Intensifier eva means that it is absolutely secluded. Secluded means away from, apart from, right? You're apart from these things. And then this word, sensual pleasures. And the Pali word here is kama. Kama has these two meanings, as I've been saying throughout this retreat. It has the meaning on the one hand of the desire, the kind of the subjective feeling of wanting something, and it also has the idea of the objects of desire, and the objects of the five senses. And these two, both of these meanings go throughout the suttas. But specifically, if you see the word in the plural, and here we're seeing the word in the plural, it has much more to do with the objects, because you have different objects of the senses, but the desire is often just looked upon as one. You just have a desire. So in the plural, the general meaning of this word is the objects of the five senses. So what we are seeing here is we're seeing what you are completely apart. This would be my translation, perhaps, completely apart from the objects of the five senses. In other words, the five senses have disappeared. If there is no objects, the senses too are gone, right? These things go together. You cannot, if there's no object, then the sense itself is no longer active, is no longer there. You can't see, you can't have sight without seeing something, right? They always go together. So what you are here, and this is I think this is a much better translation of this. You have completely abandoned the world of the five senses. There's nothing left of these five senses. This is what's happening here. So this gives you then some idea of how profound these states are. You're moving into a completely different realm where the five senses cannot coexist with this realm. You're moving away from that. And you see that in the suttas. There is one sutta where it says that only when the sounds disappear, sound is a thorn to the first jhana, only when that thorn of sound has disappeared can you enter the first jhana. Sound is usually the last of the senses to disappear as samadhi becomes deeper. And then you have secluded from unwholesome states, and unwholesome states are kusala dhamma. These are the five hindrances, right? All the things that weaken wisdom, panya dubala karana, the weak makers of wisdom, these are the unwholesome states. And that, of course, includes the subjective part of sensuality. That's where the subjective part of having sensual desire is included, right? So there's two things here that you have to get away from. One is the five hindrances, and the other one is the world of the sensual world altogether. And only then does he enter upon and abide in the first jhana, right? So you do this and you enter upon it and abide in it. It's like a state that you're going into. And once you go into this state, you kind of stay in there until you come out naturally again. You can't really do anything within that state. So you just have to wait. You're blissfully happy for the endurance of that state. And that is the other aspect of this which I talked about very briefly at the very beginning of the retreat as well. The other aspect of the jhana is that you enter into a state and you can't do anything. So you have given up your ability to act, right? You've given up your ability to intend, to do this and do that. And this is also one reason why these states are sometimes a bit, can seem a bit difficult to enter at least initially. Because you are giving up something which is very close to you, something which you identify with, the actor, the doer, the one who's always in charge. And this is why this is so hard. So you enter into a state and you just stay there, and you can't actually, you don't have any power anymore to do what you want. You just stay in there. And then it's accompanied, it says here, by applied and sustained thought. The idea of thought here needs to be understood in a very, very broad sense. Thought here, remember that what we're talking about here, once you get to the second jhana, all of this is completely abandoned, right? There's no thought, it's completely without vitakka and vichara. So this is the very last remainder of what might be called thought. So what is the very last remainder of what might be called thought? Well, it is basically, if thought in the wider sense is like any movement of the mind, thought ultimately is a movement of the mind, right? You're going here, going there, thinking, sometimes you verbalize, sometimes you see picture. All of this movement of the mind is what thought really is. So this is the very last remainder of the movement of the mind. That is what is meant here. So it doesn't mean verbalizing. In fact, the suttas are very explicit that you have abandoned any kind of verbalization before you enter jhana. All it means is a very slight movement of the mind. That's all that is left in this jhana state. So again, you have to be careful when you read these things. You have to understand what is going on here. There is, in the Chinese translation of these words, they actually use a different word in the jhana than they use for thought outside of jhana, just to make that distinction clear. Then, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion, so this is a specific type of rapture and pleasure, right? It's the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion that we have just seen from the five hindrances and also from the five senses. Is that type of rapture and pleasure. It's not just any rapture and pleasure, it's a very specific one. And of course, a very powerful one, a very still one, something very beautiful, something that is kind of otherworldly. We're moving, quite literally, this is otherworldly now. We're moving away from the world where we usually hang out and reside. We're moving into a different world altogether. So these are happiness and pleasures of a type that you have never, ever experienced before. And again, just going back to what I said at the very beginning of this course, we're talking about the psychology of meditation, right? Where you start off with being virtuous, you develop your character in a good way, you have non-remorse, you have pamuja, the gladness, then you have the piti, the rapture or the joy, then you have pasadi, then you have sukha, right? One happiness after the other, one more powerful than the next one. And only then, after sukha, do you come to samadhi. And samadhi is what we're talking about now. So you go through all these stages of happinesses, right? One after the other. It's kind of a wonderful path. It's an astonishing path. There's just happiness upon happiness upon happiness. Until you reach this happiness, which is like an otherworldly type of happiness. From one thing to another one. Further, you know, more and more powerful, more and more blissful as you go through this. And this shows that what we have here in the jhana is not just any old happiness and bliss. It's something extraordinary. Something quite literally out of this world, right? You have left the world, the five senses, and now you're seeing something which is just completely, completely beyond that. So remember that. It is so common for people to overestimate themselves. They get happiness in meditation, and sometimes they get very powerful happiness. And they think, yeah, jhana, okay, jhana has the happiness, the rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This must be jhana because I'm experiencing happiness. I'm experiencing very powerful happiness. This has to be jhana. What else could it possibly be here? Chances are it isn't. Chances are you're still on the way to jhana because there's so much happiness to be had even before you get there. The vast majority of people, I'm very sure they overestimate their states of samadhi. They think they have got what they haven't got, because these things are incredibly profound. You are talking about moving in away from the whole world as we know it. So please keep that in mind. It's not bad, you know, if you haven't got the jhana, you thought you had one, it's not bad. Rather, it makes this path even more exciting, right? You had so much happiness, and there's even more to be had. Wow, this is just it's amazing. Yeah. And that is a kind of part of the beauty of this Buddhist path, the kind of the degree of spiritual happiness that is available is just astonishing. Yeah. So that is the rapture and happiness born of seclusion. And in the second jhana, you have the rapture and pleasure born of samadhi, because then the mind is completely unified. There's absolutely no movement. It's like you're sitting there for hour upon hour upon hour, 4 or 5 hours, and absolutely nothing happens. It's the same state, completely immovable for 4 or 5 hours, right? That's what the kind of the second jhana is about. So again, it is something, and you're very, very happy, right? You're extremely happy being there. So this is what these things are. It's very hard to, you cannot really understand these things, of course. The Buddha says that you have to experience these things, but it gives you some idea what these things are about. So, and then comes the last part here, which is so powerful, when the Buddha says to this man who is there with him, this Brahmana is called a footprint of the Tathagata, the Buddha, something scraped by the Tathagata, something marked by the Tathagata. But a noble disciple does not yet come to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully awakened, etc. So remember, we're doing the simile of the elephant's footprint, right? And just like you are, when you go into the woods and you see the footprint, the large footprint, and you see something scraped high up, then you have some idea that this is probably a large elephant. You're not 100% sure yet, because you haven't seen the elephant with your own eyes. You're getting the feeling that this must be something special, because you see these things. And so this is what's happening here. When you get to the first jhana, you're getting into the vicinity of the Buddha. You're getting close. You're seeing, wow, if there is a Buddha, he would have done these kind of things. This is the kind of footstep that the Buddha would leave behind, right? So a jhana is basically a mark of the Buddha. This is where the mark is. You cannot be 100% sure yet that this actually is a Buddha. It could be maybe something else, somebody who hasn't quite reached that level. But you know that the Buddha would have been through this, would have been part of this. So this is the power, and this is one of the things that you kind of find throughout the suttas, is this very extreme elevation of these jhanas. So you have the jhanas, and then you have the four levels of awakening. We're talking about before, the stream enter, the once returner, the non-returner, etc. And they are always talked about together as part of the same kind of grouping. And they are called things like the superhuman achievements, right? The attainments beyond the human, human realm. They're called the knowledge and distinction in knowledge and vision of the noble ones, because this is where the noble ones kind of hang out in the jhanas and the stages of awakening. They're called here the footprint of the Buddha, right? You're getting in the vicinity of the Buddha. You're starting to understand what the Buddha is when you get into the jhanas. That's quite amazing. It is called the Sambodha Sukha, the happiness of awakening. Right? This is a word for the jhanas. And as you go through the suttas, you can see more and more of these kind of descriptions, which just places these jhanas in a very, very high level. And for that reason, again, these things are extremely profound, and they are basically your entire world view of the world is changing as you're moving into these states. Sometimes people say, this person has a lot of samatha, but they have no insight. But that is not how the path works. It is impossible to have a jhana without having insight, because insight is precisely measured by how much you are able to abandon. This is specifically in the suttas. If you have wisdom, you are able to abandon things. And the jhanas are a measurement of your ability to abandon. So these go together. You cannot have one without the other. Sammatha vipassana are a function of the practice of the path. The further down the path you are, the more you have of both sammatha and vipassana. I think it is not quite correct to understand vipassana as a particular type of meditation. Vipassana is a result of the practice that you're doing here. So, and all practice which is done correctly leads to both samatha and vipassana. So a person who has got the jhanas will be someone who has a lot of insight into the Buddha's teachings, very profound insight already. And if you can't attain these jhanas, it means that your insight hasn't matured yet, because it takes wisdom to be able to attain these things. So there you are. That is the first jhana. And then the sutta continues with the second jhana, then the third jhana, then the fourth jhana. And as you move along, it becomes more and more profound, right? You are abandoning more and more stuff. Things are falling away, and things are getting more and more profound as you move along. So more and more powerful states. And then eventually, once you have attained the four jhanas, it doesn't have to be perhaps all the four, but at least the more you have them, the more powerful it is. Then the last part of the sutta, and the Buddha still says, you still cannot come to the conclusion the Blessed One is fully enlightened, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, the Sangha is practicing the good way. You haven't come to that conclusion yet, but you are still in the vicinity of the Buddha. You know that this is a footprint of the Buddha, but you haven't actually seen the Buddha yet. And then at the very end, you come to where you actually start to see the Buddha. And this is where, first of all, based on those four jhanas, you remember your past lives, right? And this is one of those massive eye-openers on the path, that suddenly you understand the world in a new way. One thing is to have confidence in the idea of many lifetimes. One thing is to sort of feel that this is probably true, and you can have maybe even feel that there is some evidence for that. But still, it is fairly shallow. Okay, there is rebirth. But actually, when you see it for yourself, that is kind of the powerful moment. That is when, whoa, this is true. And you start to feel what it actually means to be reborn. You start to feel what it means to be doing the same stupid things again, life after life, right? Always kind of messing it up. Always kind of following in the same footprints from before. Always kind of getting in the same rut and the same habits, going from lifetime to lifetime. And then you think, oh, this is terrible. I'm not getting anywhere. I'm just, stuck in the same suffering, the same problems. I've had enough of this. So this is one of the things about actually seeing these things. It is incredibly powerful. Confidence is very weak compared to actually seeing these things. And this is why, this is the stuff which actually leads you towards awakening. Because now, for the first time, you understand that you don't want to go on like this. You don't want to continue being reborn into the future. Because it's a completely pointless exercise in suffering. That's what it is. Rebirth is a completely pointless exercise in suffering. That's what it is. So why do you want to keep on going like that? You don't. And you realize, no, I don't want to do this anymore. And then you move on to the understanding the laws of karma, and understanding the potential for rebirth in the different realms, how you go up and down, how now you go here, now you go there, moving back and forth always, round and round. And again, that even makes it even more powerful, this feeling that you've got to get off the wheel of samsara. And this, because you have seen that the world is basically problematic, it is so much suffering in this world, it's such a problematic thing, that is how awakening becomes possible. The destruction of the asava, in particular the asava, which is the craving for existence. What you're doing here is you're undermining the craving for existence. You don't really want to exist anymore. You don't want to go on like this. It's pointless. So once the craving for existence is abandoned, that is when the asavas can be destroyed. The asavas are the defilements that keep you going round and round. In particular, the bhavasava, the asava for it to exist. And you can make the breakthrough. And that is the end of the path. And when you come to the end of the path, what do you know? What you know is birth is destroyed. There's no more coming back to this state of existence, right? That is what you know. That's what the arahant knows. That's the knowledge they have, because that's the purpose of the Buddhist path. And there you have made an end of suffering. All has been overcome. And then the Buddha says, now you come to the conclusion that the Blessed One is fully enlightened. Because now you know that the only way that the Buddha would have been able to teach this teaching is because he had these insights himself. It's the only way, because these insights are so profound, and he wouldn't have been able to teach this without having those himself. So the Buddha must have seen exactly what I have seen. He's fully awakened. The Dhamma is well proclaimed. Svakato Bhagavata Dhammo, right? The Dhamma is well proclaimed. In other words, you know that these teachings are work. And the Sangha is practicing the good way. Those people who are Aryas are practicing what works. So that is the whole gradual training for you from beginning to end. And this last stuff I've been reading about now, this is the result. This is what we're heading towards. And it's just sometimes mind-bogglingly profound, right? It's hard to relate to these things. But it's sort of... the longer you are a Buddhist, the more you start to be able to relate to these things. And it is something very powerful and beautiful about all this, which I think is, at least for me, very inspiring. Yeah? And that's why I'm taking it all the way to the end like that, so you can get some feeling for what is going on. So how does this relate then to the Noble Eightfold Path? I've been talking about the Noble Eightfold Path throughout this, and how this relates to the Noble Eightfold Path. So once we come to the abandoning of the five hindrances I just talked about before, that relates to Samma Sati, right mindfulness, right? Satipatthanas. And then the four jhanas, that's Samma Samadhi. That's Samadhi on the Noble Eightfold Path. And then what about the Tevijja? What about the knowledges that arise from that Samadhi? And they are not part of the Noble Eightfold Path, because the Noble Eightfold Path is a path. And the path really stops with the Samadhi and all the stuff that comes from that. If you practice that path correctly, if you get into Samadhi, and that Samadhi is based on the right view at the very beginning that you start out with, then these are the natural results of practicing that path. If you start out with right view and then you have Samma Samadhi, then the results will come all by themselves. So that is why the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, stops at that particular point. But the gradual training shows you what happens all the way until you reach full awakening here. So let's have a quick look at the very last sutta. We've got a few minutes left, so we can just squeeze that sutta in, I think. This last little sutta is just the Buddha basically inspiring his monks. And this is what the Buddha says in this very last sutta, the Gotamaka Sutta. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Vesali, at the Gotamaka shrine. There the Blessed One addressed the monks. Monks, I teach the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge. I teach the Dhamma with a basis or foundation, not without a foundation. I teach a Dhamma that is wonderful, or wonderful is a good translation, not one that is not. Since I teach the Dhamma through direct knowledge, not without direct knowledge, since I teach the Dhamma with a basis, not without basis, since I teach the Dhamma that is wonderful, not one that is not, my teaching should be acted upon, my instructions should be acted upon. It is enough for you to rejoice, enough for you to be elated, enough for you to be joyful. The Blessed One is perfectly awakened. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One. And the Sangha is practicing the good way here. So the point here, the Buddha says, is that I have seen this. This is the Dhamma. It's not some theory, right? This is direct knowledge that I have. Abhinya is the Pali word. Abhinya means direct, immediate knowledge. And this Dhamma, it is without a base, it has a base, it has a foundation, because it is based on direct knowledge, and because all of this is about causality and how the world works according to cause and effect, this Dhamma has a foundation and a basis. It is not something which kind of hangs in thin air without a proper support. And the last one, the Dhamma that is wonderful, this is the Patiharya. Patiharya is like the... It's a word which means almost something like miracle, but not quite. It means, because miracle is something which a miracle in Christianity is something which is outside the laws of physics, right? Outside of the world. But this is more like a wonder, something that is marvelous and amazing, something you don't actually expect to see in the world. And in Buddhism, the greatest wonder in Buddhism, the Buddha says, forget about mind reading, right? We talked about mind reading yesterday. Forget about that. That's not wonderful at all. Often it's used in the wrong way. Forget about, what's the other thing he says you should forget about? Psychic power. I'm just thinking about which one of them. I think maybe just general psychic powers, about kind of flying through the air, that sort of thing. That's not really wonderful. That's irrelevant, right? That's what he says. In fact, he goes so far to say somewhere that I despise and I look down upon these kind of psychic powers, because they often get misunderstood. The real wonder in Buddhism is the wonder, or called the wonder of instruction. That is the wonder that when you instruct somebody and they act upon it, it does give the result, right? If you act upon the instruction, but you have to investigate, you have to be appamada, you have to be heedful, you have to be careful, you have to be wise, you have to apply yourself in the right way. But if you do all of these things in the right way, if you apply yourself in the way, then the result is, the Buddha says, you too, everyone, will be able to achieve the results, 10 results. And that is the miracle, the wonder, the marvel of the Buddhist path, that this is possible. And that is why the Buddha says, this is enough for you to be happy, to rejoice, right? Happiness is available to you, even more than you already have. So this path works, it is profound, it is effective. So get going, get started, practice this, and then you will reap the benefit. So that is how you get some happiness by reflecting about the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha in the right way. Okay. Very good. So that is the end of this retreat, I suppose. So now it's just a matter of putting it all into practice. So thank you all for coming here. So thank you everyone for coming, and I